Thank you very much. Thank you for invitation and just having the opportunity to see the Fields Institute in Toronto, a bit of Toronto. After this excellent introduction to what local index formula is, I just feel somehow obliged to do, I mean, okay, it's right, to say a little bit on examples. I mean, theory, which gives you some sort of formula, is very nice, but I mean, what you actually need sometimes is some examples and work out some examples. And in particular, I mean, we know that for more or less all reasonable examples in commutative, for commutative manifolds, it works very, very fine. So the thing is to see, I mean, what are the limits, and what are actually the interesting examples in non-commutative geometry? So in other sense, what are the non-commutative manifolds that you can apply this formula to? And I mean, the general formulation as we had, I mean, the natural formulation is that in the language of spectral triplets, which just assumes very, very little that you have an algebra, representation of the algebra as bounded operators on a Hilbert space, some sort of an operator that is called Dirac operator, and plus some regularity conditions. And this is, so to say, natural setup in which you can consider local index formula. Now, of course, to construct the examples of something like non-commutative manifolds, non-commutative spectral geometries, I mean, having an algebra is not sometimes a very big deal. I mean, we have a lot of examples of interesting, more or less interesting non-commutative algebras. The crucial thing is to get, you know, this data of a spectral triple, in particular Dirac operator, which would satisfy certain conditions. And I mean, in recent years, I mean, there's been not really very many examples that would qualify as, you know, for as a good testing ground for the thing. I mean, only recently, I mean, there appeared two, so to say, set of interesting things. Set of interesting directions that might lead us, I mean, might just set the ground for the, you know, further investigation of Dirac operators, spectral triples, of better understanding what this actual notion is. I mean, whether the axioms of Kohn are valid, whether you can extend them, whether you can modify them. I mean, just setting the basic ideas, setting the basic notions of what a spectral geometry, what Dirac operator might be. I would be talking about two examples, I mean, that are, so to say, more recent. The first one is the direction that goes towards the Q-deform spaces, I mean, quantum deformations that stems from quantum groups, and particularly is closely related to SUQ2, which has been a favorite toy of people doing Hopf algebras and quantum groups for many, many years. And it's been only until recently that, I mean, the, so to say, common belief was that the non-commutative geometry a la Kohn, you know, the spectral triple approach, and the ideas of Hopf algebras are somehow, of quantum groups, are somehow not really in the same, you know, stream. And only recently, I mean, there's been, you know, so to say, very constructive examples how to construct spectral triples, or something that's, you know, similar to spectral triples, because you have to modify some of the axioms. I'll be talking about it. For, in particular, for Podolite spheres, I mean, the first example was for the so-called standard Podolite sphere, because there's a family of Podolite spheres, which are, roughly speaking, deformation of a two-dimensional sphere that carry on the symmetry in the sense of the quantum symmetry, quantum SU2. There's a family of this Podolite sphere. The first example was for the standard Podolite sphere. Then this year, actually, I mean, months ago, came the second example with the equatorial Podolite sphere. And I think, I mean, we are more or less now understand what's going on for the entire family. I mean, what would be for the entire family. And I hope soon, something like in a you know, month's time or, I mean, depending how fast writing up the paper will go, we'll have an example for SUQ2, so for the something like Q deformation of a three sphere. So that's the first set of examples. I mean, they have some sort of common patterns. I mean, they closely related to symmetries, quantum symmetries, and well, they show one path that, you know, the things related to the local index formula to the Dirac operators might go. There's a second example, I mean a single example, but of course you can go on and generalize it, which related to something which are group algebras. I mean, there's, if you have discrete groups, I mean you have of course group algebras. I mean, in particular, I mean, I was looking at a discrete Heisenberg group, which is closely related to the non-commutative torus. So this sort of a natural, I wouldn't say generalization, but it's sort of non-commutative. I mean, you can view it as a non-commutative manifold that is sort of a very nice generalization, which is not directly non-commutative torus, but related to non-commutative torus. But still, it goes beyond, you know, the standard deformations in the sense of theta deformations or non-commutative torus deformations. So, the questions, well, which are quite natural to be posed, is first, I mean, is the picture, I mean, the notion of spectral triples as posed by Kohn, and I remember you, I just remind, I mean, for the, so this is ADH, I mean, whatever, direction you whatever order you admit, which is an algebra represented as bounded operators on a Hilbert space, plus some Dirac operator, plus some regularity conditions. Usually, I mean, in a Kohn's approach, a recent Kohn's approach, you might add two decorations to that, which is in even case there's a Gazito grading, and in any case, I mean, for any spectral triples, you can add something which is called reality condition, reality operation. In particular, this is related to the, this enforces some further conditions on the Dirac operator D called the first order condition. I mean, I will not, you know, go first order condition, which basically, I mean, roughly speaking, corresponds to the situation that you have, that the Dirac operator is the first, in a classical case, the first order differential operator. Now, I mean, I'm talking about this two decorations that you use, because they are somehow crucial in the determining the Dirac operator, at least in this case, and this in the Q deform case. I mean, we strongly used it to fix the Dirac operator. Roughly speaking, I mean, assuming this algebraic part of the spectral data as given by Kohn, plus assuming some equivariance property with respect to the symmetries, to the natural symmetries that these spaces carry, the first order condition just fixes the Dirac operator up to a constant, but I mean that doesn't play actually a role. So it fixes the Dirac operator, so you get it, you actually can derive it. So these are the questions. I mean, the second question, I mean, is the formula that you can get, the Kohn-Moscovici formula, local index formula, I mean, does it make sense? I mean, you will see that the Dirac operators, or something that you can call Dirac operators, are not really the ones we learned about. So, I mean, I will start with the second thing, so with the Heisenberg group algebra, which very nice thing. You can see it as an algebra generated by three unitaries, something like a torus, but the commutation relations are UW is WU, so W is basically central, so VW is WV, but the commutation relation WUV is VU. So if you make, you can map this algebra onto the non-commutative torus, just putting W into I phi, into, so just number of complex number of modulus 1. So the other description is the cross product of functions on the torus by Z. You can see there are many ways of, you know, looking at the algebra as continuous field on non-commutative tori, and well, okay, that's one of the notions. I mean, why to look at this algebra in the very first reason is, I mean, I personally came it through sort of a, you know, round way, because that looked like some sort of deformations that were that were first proposed for the spheres. I mean, there's been the deformation of the spheres proposed by Kohn and Landy, theta spheres, which just involve some arbitrary constant parameter. And then it appeared that if you make this parameter depending, I mean, not constant, but depending on an extra variable which is central, then you also get something which looks like a deformation of the sphere. I mean, this relates to the so-called Matsumoto spheres, and they satisfy more or less the same condition, cohomological condition that was put for the spheres and derived for the spheres that Kohn and Landy did. So that was the motivation. And then the most trivial example, I mean, the more trivial example of deformation of this type will be actually this Heisenberg group algebra. I mean, you can just look at it. I mean, it's something like, you know, you take a three torus, take a deformation of the two torus within this three torus. So say VU take UV and e to the I phi, and then make phi not constant but depending on the extra variable, depending on the extra central coordinate. So that's the basic idea. Now, the good thing is that a lot of things are known actually about this algebra, and that's been, you know, sort of a benefit. I mean, I just listing a couple of names and references. I mean, the references, I mean, the first thing is a paper by Joe Anderson, William Paschke, it's from 1989, Judith Packer, and they studied basically K-theory. And there's a sort of very comprehensive review of all these results and of new results by Tom Hatfield. I'm listing here only the archives numbers, but that's been published already. So I apologize that I don't give the journal references. So if you know to anything about K-theory, K-homology, Hochschild and cyclic, I mean, just look at that. I mean, that's been done there. Now, I mean, the other good thing is that, I mean, you can say everything about the smooth. I mean, you can view the algebra, of course, as sister algebra. You can view the algebra as on level of polynomial algebra. You can also have something like, in the case of non-commutative torus, as a smooth subalgebra. You can study derivation. It's basically everything all right. I mean, for instance, if you look at the Hochschild and you say, what's the dimension of it? I mean, treat it as sort of a non-commutative manifold and assume that the dimension of the manifold corresponds to the dimension of the Hochschild homology, then the dimension of this H3 is 3. I mean, it's of good dimension, it's a very nice algebra. Well, so try to find a spectral triple. So what came to my mind is this: first, try to find a spectral triple, and try having the spectral triple, try to actually calculate the local index formula. Very good. So first, I mean, it would be nice to know what's the cyclic cocycle in dimension 3, and basically, I mean, to know how to pair it with K-theory. And of course, I mean, using Nest duality result, I mean, one can actually know that, I mean, the derivation of the cyclic homology and the pairing, I mean, could go through the Nest duality result. That's the way applied by Tom Hatfield. If you want details, just look at his paper. But I mean, what I was basically interested, I'm interested in the, you know, things that, you know, can be applied, say, in mathematical physics. In mathematical physics, I mean, talking about things is basically talking, I mean, you want to have Dirac operator, whatever, differential calculus, sort of a nice trace. So just, you know, practical things and more or less more explicitly written. So the question is there a Dirac operator? Very good. Let's try. But I mean, before trying that, I mean, you need to have some sort of a look at K-theory first. I mean, just to give you a glimpse what the K-theory is. I mean, K0 has three generators. It's a 1, then a PU and PV. There are certain projections related to the operators U and V, and they could be written in a very funny way. I mean, it's not really very, very important. I mean, with 2x2 matrices, so they are projections in 2x2 matrices over the algebra. K1 is also not very complicated. If you look at 2 first, I mean, it's also 3-dimensional, and it's not very complicated if you look at three two generators, which are just the generators of the algebra U and V, what's very complicated is the third generator of the K1, which, I mean, we call it Z1, I mean, it's after actually this paper by Anderson Paschke. And if you look at the explicit, I mean, that's the so to say abbreviated formula for Z1, but if you look at the explicit formula for Z1, I mean, it's hopeless. I mean, it's something like 50 terms. I mean, I'm using here these functions of pi t is just simply because, I mean, you can write this central element w, you can write as a function of t. This is just a circle. So, I mean, this just simplifies writing it up. I mean, not in terms of polynomials or series in w. So that's the explicit formula. You can admire it. I mean, it's not very, you know, tough. But it's not very practical, I mean, either. The thing is, I mean, of course, if you want to, you know, get cyclic cocycle, and if you want to pair it, I mean, here, you remember, this is a three-dimensional thing. So you want a top three-dimensional cyclic cocycle, and you want to pair it actually with Z1. So that's the thing. So, okay, I mean, so that's also just briefly what I mentioned, I mean, the results on Hochschild and cyclic. I mean, that's been derived already, but I mean, the good reference, if you want to look, is Hesketh's papers. Now, well, on cyclic cohomology, I mean, what one can mention, I mean, there are, so to say, two one-cyclic co-cycles that have non-trivial pairing with these elements of K1, U, and V. And the thing is, I mean, to find a non-trivial three-cyclic co-cycle and to pair it with Z1. And then, I mean, okay, the first is to find it explicitly. The second thing is to derive it through the local index formula. Now, the approach I took, I mean, it's a sort of a very naive approach. I mean, cyclic co-cycles, I mean, that we learn from many books, I mean, can come from something which is called a K-cycle, which is a differential graded algebra over the algebra and some closed graded trace. So, I mean, very, very naive thing is, you know, okay, what do we have here? I mean, we actually have a group algebra, so we have a symmetry. I mean, there's a group. So we can have a look having something like a group and having a group algebra or a function on a group looking for a differential calculi. I mean, the natural thing is to look for the, you know, Voronteg-Voronovich and look for the Baikovarian differential calculi. So, I mean, of course, I mean, not for all of them, but what I wanted to look is just to look for the Baikovarian differential calculi over this algebra H3, so the Heisenberg group algebra, where omega 1 is a free left module. I mean, actually, what I wanted is the free left module generated by du, dv, and dw. Basically, I mean, it boils down to the thing that if you project it, I mean, you can always project it on the torus or on the circle within it, so you get a normal differential calculus on a circle or on a torus. So it's not a big deal. I mean, you can derive what are the possibilities, so what are the possible differential calculi, and the first result is that there's a one-parameter family of Baikovarian differential calculi, and they're basically given by these rules. So what do you have? I mean, you have three generating one forms, omega u, omega v, omega w, which basically, I mean, if you have a look at that, I mean, it looks similarly to the non-commutative torus. I mean, on non-commutative torus, you also have these things. The only difference is that, the commutation rules between the bimodal structure of omega 1 is different. And it came sort of a surprise that actually you have a one-parameter family. So gamma here is an absolutely arbitrary real parameter. The form omega w is central, but the non-trivial relations are between u and omega v and v and omega u. And of course, I mean, having Baikovarian differential calculus, there's a canonical way to create, this is first order differential calculus, but there's a canonical way to create higher order forms, and you can actually check that the dimension of the differential graded algebra is 3, that is the top form is the 3 form, so everything is fine. So, that's it. Now you go a little bit farther. All right, so I mean, this is briefly just restating it. You have this bicameral differential calculus. I mean, the form anti-commute, there's this this omega 3, which is actually one dimensional. So this is generated by one form, omega u, omega v, omega w, and this form is central. And then what do you look? You look for a closed graded trace. And just taking, I mean, so any three form is of the types x, where x is in the algebra, times omega, which is this three form. You just propose, I mean, just the, you know, the easiest thing to do is to suggest that that you take the integral, I mean, this closed graded trace, I mean, this trace, just as a trace of x. And the algebra, I mean, the Heisenberg-Gruber algebra curve is just a natural trace. So, right. And then, I mean, what you can actually prove that this is a closed graded trace on this algebra. I mean, independent of gamma. So you have for the entire family of this bicameral differential calculi, you have a closed graded trace. So you have a family of k cycles. So I mean, some of these transformations actually repeat themselves because they were written partially. Not for two projectors, but for one. So then it's sometimes nice to repeat a little bit of that. All right. And what's the trace? I mean, here's just explicitly written. What's the trace? It's just one when it's one on one and zero on other on other elements on other polynomials. All right. So, okay. Just we have a k cycle. So we have a three-cyclic co-cycle, I mean, just by the standard formula. In fact, we are having two-cyclic co-cycles, because remember that we have this parameter gamma, and actually you can write so this you can see that this cyclic co-cyclic gamma splits into part which independent of gamma, and a part which linear in gamma. I mean, this comes out. I mean, if you do the calculations. So, and basically, I mean, just by the standard argument, I mean, each of them is a cyclic cocycle. Now, the thing is that the one which is proportional to gamma is a trivial one. So, basically, I mean, of course, I mean, you can use either of them. I mean, it doesn't depend. So, it means that the cohomology classes is just the same. Now, what I took the pain here is just to write it explicitly. I mean, the formula is actually not very, you know, enlightening, but I mean, you can amuse yourself, do it. I mean, that was the useful at a later stage, just, you know, to have this explicit formula for the cyclic cocycle. I mean, having it, I mean, you can actually test that it is a cyclic cocycle, just explicitly. All right. Very good. So we have a cyclic cocycle. Of course, we can pair it with the element of K1. I just wonder whether we... I can... I will do about the pairing, because, I mean, the pairing, I mean, actually... I mean, at this stage, you can actually do the pairing with K1. Having the cyclic cocycle, you can do the pairing. But, I mean, I mentioned it a little bit later, I mean... when mentioning the and that was actually crucial. I mean, actually the formulation of the cyclic cocycle in terms of the k cycles of cancel in terms of the differential forms was crucial to actually calculate the index formula. So now, can we construct a spectral triple? I mean, so now the task is, okay, we know what is three cyclic cocycle. Now the thing is, can we construct the spectral triple? Can we construct the Dirac operator so that the local index formula for this Dirac operator would give us this three-cyclic cocycle? And the answer is, there will be an appendix. So the answer is actually yes, but what I wanted to do first is to follow the route that we took for many, many other examples. I mean, starting from non-commutative torus, when you can amuse yourself, do the things, then for the quantum spaces, you just apply two certain rules. So first, you apply these algebraic conditions that are set by Kono on the spectral triple, with something like the existence of J, the existence of order one condition, and so on and so forth. And then what's an additional piece of information that you add? Well, you add the symmetry. You add here, actually, there's a group, but what I wanted is actually to have the symmetry in the same sense that you have a symmetry for the non-commutative torus. The symmetry for the non-commutative torus is U1 cross U1, which, you can see that you have two derivations. I mean, here, the symmetry you can express in terms of a commutative Hopf algebra, that I mean generated by three elements that commute with each other, but the co-product is a trivial one. It's not U1, U1, U1. I mean, for the LU and LV, this is actually U1 cross U1 part, but the co-product of LW, this is not a derivation. This is something like a derivation that includes parts of LV and LU. Now, what you want to do is, this procedure that one can somehow establish in deriving, step-by-step deriving spectral triples, is the following. You have the symmetry. You just look for the representation that carries on this symmetry. That means you look for the equivariant representation on a Hilbert space. You look for some equivariant operators J and gamma. You look for equivariant D, satisfying first order condition. And then, in principle, you should just get the answer. Now, the thing is, here it doesn't work. But, what came to my mind is just first simple thing. Can we find, we have this equivariant representation. It's basically written here up there. So you take the, this is L2 of z to the power z cube, the Hilbert space. You have the representation of LU, LV, and LW, of this quasi-derivation, densely defined representation just by eigenvalues. And then you can see that the representation of U, V, and W, just as shifts in this Hilbert space, is an equivariant representation. And so it's, to some extent, if you look at it, it is very similar to non-commutative torus. Now, can we find an operator? The first approach was, can we find an operator D such that the one forms obtained as operators on the Hilbert space, not necessarily bounded. I just have to warn you that they will not be bounded, gives actually the first order differential calculus. And the answer is yes, you can find it. And this Dirac operator, then you have to take not the you have to double the Hilbert space, but that's the trick actually that you do for the non-commutative torus as well. So you double the Hilbert space, so it turns out with C2, so you have 2x2 matrices. And then this operator D, written here in this, so it's eigenspaces, so this is just E KLM, one of the vector in the basis on the Hilbert space, written as matrices, is something like that. And this is okay, this is just to express this family of differential calculus, so I introduce here this parameter gamma. And this parameter gamma, basically what you see that you put gamma minus 1/2, then what you get is M, K plus IL, K minus IL, and minus M, which is nothing else but the Dirac operator for the usual three torus. You can express then the differential in terms of these connections, of these derivations. Now, what are the properties of D? So, assume for a while that, we depart from the, Kohn's axioms, so we forget, because, one thing is, this has not been, derived. That you might trust me that, deriving it step by step doesn't actually do anything, but you just assume that this is what we take. What are the properties of that? Now, first of all, I mean, that's what I said, if you take gamma being minus 1/2, this just, I mean, the spectral properties, spectrally, is just the Dirac operator on 3 torus. Now, what you can actually go and prove, I mean, it's not also a very, very big deal, I mean, you can formulate a small lemma that the spectral properties of this operator are independent of gamma. So actually, for the entire family of gamma, you have the spectral properties, which are the same. And basically, I mean, it belongs to the same class as this is the same class of operators as the Dirac operator on the torus. And basically, if you take d gamma to the power minus 3, an absolute value of that to the power minus 3, then you can calculate the Wojcicki residue of that. Sorry, it's a Dismuth trace of that, which comes out, I mean, this is, you know, the standard answer is 8 over 3 pi. Very good. Now for some certain reasons, I mean, sometimes it's convenient to work with gamma being 0 or gamma being minus 1/2, because we know that this actually doesn't actually matter. I mean, there's been sometimes I take gamma minus 1/2, but in some other parts I took gamma 0. This simplifies quite a lot. So now, what are the commutators? If you look at the commutators between this operator, I would not call it Dirac operator at the moment, but say candidate for what we can call Dirac operator and the coordinates, then you can see that they split into two parts. So first part is bounded with U tensor sum matrix, but there's another part which involves this LV and LU, which are these operators, which are the derivations on the Hilbert, which you can represent on the Hilbert space, which are unbounded. So basically, this condition that comes out that dA is bounded is not satisfied here. Well, furthermore, you can go on and try to introduce real spectral triple. So this operator J, I mean, this you can do it. I mean, that's not a big deal. And you can have dj being jd, so all these conditions should be satisfied. But you have no other one condition. So if you try to say, so this is not bounded, and order one condition doesn't hold. I mean, you can go a little bit beyond it, because if you look at the order one condition, I mean, these are the only things that are not zero in this order one condition. Then you can see that, okay, this is not really zero, but it's bounded. So for instance, if you commute once again with something, then you will actually get zero, or something that is a discompact. All right, very good. But then, what kind of came as a surprise is, if you have a look at the commutation relation, I mean, this is not bounded, but, I mean, this involves the things like this du, du, dv, which is, you know, if you look at the order of that, that's smaller than the order of this Dirac operator. So, basically, I mean, what I wanted to say, I mean, well, does the formula for a cocycle, cyclic cocycle, make sense? The thing is, I mean, if you look at a Kon-Moscovici paper, I mean, there's a formula for a cocycle in the BB bicomplex, this is 42, and I think what is more interesting is 43. This is for the case of three-dimensional manifold. So this is the formula for the three-cyclic cocycle, right? Do I have... Right, okay. So here is the definition, what's tau q. This is the residue of certain function with d to the power, to the complex power. And then you can see, I mean, no much, I mean, it doesn't actually matter very much that the commutators here are bounded. I mean, if you take this formula, I mean, if this is the residue of z being 0, some operator and d absolute value of d to minus to z. So if the real part of z is, you know, large enough, this absolutely makes sense. So the thing is, I mean, it will make sense, I mean, here. So let's try and do it. And the funny thing is, I mean, you can just plug in the operator that you have. I mean, D is, basically it's like Dirac operator on the three torus, so you know it exactly well. I mean, you know with spatial behavior, you can calculate all these residues. I mean, the other thing is, I mean, you just multiply matrices and polynomials in the coordinates. So what you actually get, I mean, this is the result. I mean, I'm not taking this as theorems or lemmas or whatever. I'm just giving you the result. The result is that this phi 1 is 0, and phi 3, there's only tau 0 contribution, which is not 0, and then you can calculate it explicitly on this, you know, on the basis of polynomial algebra. So you take abstract polynomials and you calculate it on the basis, and it comes out actually the same cocycle that I had a while ago. So just to refresh your memory, I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, okay. It just comes out the same cocycle. I mean, there's a factor which is a little bit different. But so it is. So what we can say, I mean, is that we get a cyclic cocycle, even though we do not actually satisfy the things that are in the, you know, basic assumptions of what Kohn and Moscovici did, so this is not bounded. Still, we get a cyclic cocycle. Now, I mean, I amuse myself, I mean, of course, you need to prove that this cyclic cocycle has a good pairing with this element of Z1. So, I mean, this is the place where actually construction of the cyclic cocycle through k-cycle comes, because it's been a little bit more easier to manipulate differential forms and manipulate just multiplying differential forms. So using the representation of the cyclic cocycle in terms of the k-cycle, you can calculate the pairing with z. I mean, here is z. Sorry, I should have written z1, right? With this element z1, right? Just as z1, something like that. These are the forms, and this is considered, you know, forms multiplication and matrix multiplication. The thing is that, okay, this is, you know, piece of that you can call it something like experimental mathematics. Because when I first tried to calculate it, I just realized, I mean, just remember what the expression for z. And the expression for z is something like z1 is something like that. So what I estimated that I have to, you know, manage something like, I mean, I gave here 3 million terms, but I mean, my estimation was something like 2 million terms that you have to commute with each other. I mean, you cannot do it in 1 day or 2 days. Unless you have a graduate student. Yeah, I mean, I had no graduate students. I had to, you know, come out with some other solution, which, I mean, this is, you know, like doing experimental mathematics. I mean, not really experimental mathematics, but doing really some calculations. And then it comes out, I mean, you can use this powerful symbolic algebra program. And forget about Maple. I mean, Maple, I mean, I tried to run it with Maple, and after a couple of days, I just had to shut it down. I mean, this is not a solution. But it's a very powerful thing, actually thought out by a physicist, for doing calculation with gamma matrices, Feynman diagrams, and all that. But it's very, very powerful to do symbolic computations. For instance, if you have to commute AB, so that it comes something, I'll say BA plus something, or something times BA, and you have to do it a million times, 2 million times, it's absolutely marvelous. So, and this is called form, so I have to do credit to Vermas Seren, who just wrote it and made it public domain. I think it is a good thing. And you just calculate it. I mean, of course, I mean, you need to know the rules and something like that. And in the end, you need to take the trace. And the trace basically means that you put everything to zero apart from what comes in a constant, yeah, at a constant term. And then the answer you get is 3 over pi times I. Anyway, it was a very reasonable answer, actually. Actually, when I did the first, the answer came something like 13 over 42, which I strongly believe was wrong. And it appeared to be wrong, apart from the fact that 42 is quite a very nice number. But anyway, so then use it and use the Kohn-Chern pairing using Kohn-Moscovici formula. I mean, what I wrote before, I mean, just this Kohn-Moscovici formula, I didn't write all the coefficients that are in front of that. So look back in the paper of Kohn-Moscovici. Look back, I mean, what's the cocycle that I got. Put all the coefficients, so it's something like minus 1, 1 over, so the coefficients that are in front of Kohn-Moscovici formula is 1 over 3 factorial, 1 over 2, tau 0, and this is the cocycle that you get. And I must say, I was very, very surprised that if you actually do this, you know, so say, first year, you know, graduate school or whatever, calculations, and it comes out that you divide by 12, multiply by 12, I cancels with minus 1, and you get 1. You get an integral pairing. I mean, that's what you would expect, actually. But this is, you know, this is not a, you know, guess. This is not derived from some, you know, high order principle or something like that. This is just calculated. So basically, well, the bottom line is, well, we have something that's not really fit as a spectral triple, because the commutators are not bounded. Well, there's not first order condition. I mean, if you care about this reality structure and something like that, but still we have something that resembles geometry. And the good thing is that the differential calculus is quite nice. I mean, it's bicovariant. I mean, it has some nice symmetries. Of course, I mean, there's a sort of a appendix to that, and the appendix is the following. That's not a big deal. I mean, actually, I won't say it's not a big deal, but, I mean, because it hasn't been done before, but when I thought about more, I mean, of course, the natural thing is, well, you know the local index formula, but the local index formula is just a presentation of the so to say, cyclic cocyclic that you can get through the Fredholm module. So the natural question is, well, try to imagine Fredholm module for that, and then you get cyclic cocycle, and then starting from the Fredholm module, you can think, okay, well, let's get an unbounded Fredholm module, which will give a spectral triple. And the answer is you can do it perfectly well. I mean, there's a Fredholm module. There's a sort of a family of Fredholm modules. There are different Fredholm modules which differ by some ability that will give you the cyclic cocycle. That's not a big deal. Or maybe S of that if they are, so to say, less summable. And you can construct something which is a spectral triple with an algebra operator D that has bounded commutators. So that's fine. And, okay, I mean, I'm just doing, you know, the local index formation for that. But I strongly believe, I mean, the answer will be, of course, the cyclic cosine. And there's no... Basically, there's no other possibility. I would be really surprised. But what's the drawback of that? And the drawback of that is that the differential calculus for this, so to say, Dirac operator that sticks to these, you know, rules is a mess. Okay, it's a mess, maybe it's a little bit of exaggeration. But remember, the differential calculus that I showed you was sort of, you know, very nice. And for instance, I mean, if you restrict it to one variable, it was just, you know, the differential calculus on a circle. If you restrict it, if you make the projection to the non-commutative torus, and you project also the differential calculus, it's just the differential calculus that you have on the non-commutative torus. I mean, it's very nice. I mean, here, I mean, if you go this way, so think of this Dirac operator which would satisfy this axiom, what it gets is that, okay, I don't want, you know, to spend much time on that. But saying mass means simply, for instance, that u du is not du, which you know, it's, I mean, it's perfectly well, but it's, you know, it's somehow awkward. All right, so that's That's for the, so to say, glimpse what the Heisenberg rule of algebra, and I want to switch, I mean, that would be, you know, shorter part, and shorter part because it's more interesting, and it's, okay, it's more recent, so to say, so basically, I mean, there are more questions than answers. It's about this Q geometry, which I mean Q deformed geometry, so geometry of the Q deformed spaces, so based on Hopf algebras which are quantum groups. And what I want to just, you know, give you the insight of are two examples. I said basically there are Podolé spheres which are just Q deformations of the two dimensional sphere, and SUQ2. And of course, I mean, giving credit, there's been many papers on spectral triple and spectral triple construction, starting from Chakraborty-Pal, myself, Ludwig Nobrowski. There's been work by Ulrich Kremer on the extension of the to the Flegg manifolds, and of course the work of Conan SUQ2, and there's been other works by Goswami and Neschwedt-Toussaint and Schmidtgen Wagner. I will mention that as well. Now, just you know, not spending much time, and was a family of Podolé sphere. I mean, just. Okay, algebraically, you look at this algebra with the following set of generators, A and B, and some relations. So AB is Q squared BA, Q squared BB star plus A square is something proportional to A plus S. S is a parameter which goes between 0 and 1. And in particular case of S being 1, you get the equatorial Podolé sphere, and the particular case S being 0, you get a standard. So these are, you know, something like two extreme points. Now, so far, I mean, what's the theorem or what's the stages of, you know, spectral geometries on this thing? Well, first, there's been proudly announced that there exists a UQSU2 equivariant spectral triple on both of them, so on standard and equatorial Podolé spheres. And they differ to some extent from each other. Of course, I mean, the algebras are not the same. But, you know, the construction of the spectral triple differs, and also the Dirac operator differs. The thing is that for the equatorial one, I mean, the one put here, that's the reason, I mean, I put it sort of in a box, you have to slightly modify the axioms of Kohn. And slightly modify, I mean, I remind you, I'm working always with this, you know, real spectral triples. Why? Because this reality condition and order one condition allows us, you know, to fix actually the Dirac operator. I mean, putting equivariance, so basically one can state it like that, that putting equivariance plus spectral triple axioms, which means basically J gamma plus order 1 gives you sort of equations for the Dirac operator that you can solve and you can get it. So, I mean, that's how I say it. I mean, we just derived the Dirac operator. We don't guess it. I mean, there's been, of course, I mean, one should mention there's been, of course, many papers before, you know, guessing the Dirac operator, like Kulisch and many others. Sorry? Kulisch, yeah. Piotr Kulisch, yeah. Actually, the paper was Kulisch-Bibikov, yeah. So, all right. So, slightly modified axioms means that this order 1, we assume, and some sort of condition on J and condition on order 1, we assume not to be 0. So, instead of being 0, we just write that this is in compact operators on the Hilbert space. So, I mean, again, saying that, you know, using the language of Kohn, an operator being compact when you have the bounded representation of the algebra is something that's infinitesimal. It's very, very small. So, I mean, it's not really very, very strange. Of course, it has some drawbacks. I mean, it has some, you know, consequences. But anyway, that's it. Maybe I put it here. I will not, you know, go through the construction. Okay, so basically, oh, I forgot that I had this. I forgot that they had this transference. So basically, that's what I said, that you know, these conditions actually are slightly modified. And this fixes uniquely the equivariant day. Now, there are very nice properties of these spectral triplets. For instance, the DA are bounded. About regularity, I mean, this is something, you know, you can still discuss. I mean, this is not, you know, well fixed. I mean, in Q geometry, I mean, there's been not really, you know, so to say, well formulated notion of regularity of these spectral triplets. I mean, this probably should follow. All right, but well, so you have D. I still have 5 minutes or something like that. Yeah, you have D. You have a spectral triple. Well, go towards the index formula. But of course, you need to bear in mind that quantum spheres are really not really interesting from this point of view if you look at that cyclic cohomology. Because, I mean, there's something that's called dimension drop. The dimension of Hochschild and cyclic cohomology, it's not the same as in a classical case. So, for instance, I mean, the cyclic cocyclists actually do live in dimension zero, and not like, you know, one in dimension zero, one in dimension two. So, what's been proposed, and I mean, the credit goes to Kusterman, Murphy, and Tested, who were the first to propose it, and then there's been calculated by Schmigel and Varga and Nefshe and Tusset for the standard Polish sphere. What's been proposed that actually the good notion is the twisted cyclic cocycle, and actually, I mean, it's been shown explicitly there exists a non-trivial twisted cyclic two cocycle on the standard Polish sphere. Twisted means that, you know, the condition that you twist, that you make the flip, right? It's not actually, you know, that you put x2 here, but there's a certain automorphism of the algebra that plays the role. And also the operator B is twisted in the sense that if you multiply, I mean, the last element, I mean, if you do the B and multiply last element by the first one, it also gets twisted by this automorphism sigma. Okay, so the theorem, I mean, the basic thing is, and this is probably, you know, the crucial point for getting understanding, towards understanding what should be or what could be the local index formula for Q geometry. I mean, this is, you know, a little bit exaggerated because on basis of one example, one couldn't actually generalize, but it at least gives you a hint. I mean, they proposed and they wrote and they proved the local index formula, so they expressed this twisted cyclic cocycle in a similar way that's been, so to say, done in the Kon-Moskovich paper. So some sort of a residue of some local formula involving the Dirac operator. What are the best things? Well, I mean, so the formula is nice. I mean, you actually get a twisted cyclic cocycle. What's bad about it? Well, at first, this gamma with index q is not actually degrading. It's not the operator gamma that you have here to construct the spectral triple. So that's the first departure. Second thing, I mean, you observe, I mean, well, what would you somehow like to have is, you know, this d to the minus z, x0, dx, y, dx2. But there's something mysterious, or I wouldn't say mysterious, but something extra standing here. And this is, you know, k that actually comes from the action of uq su2. So you have the action of uq su2 represented on a Hilbert space, and there's an operator k which, actually induces this automorphism of the algebra that comes to the twist. Now, so it's not very much like, you know, Kon-Moskovich formula, but it's somehow going towards this direction. So I'll just think of it as a hint. And sorry? Oh, the theorem says that this is a so something like that. I mean, lambda is some constant depending on q. Sorry? Tau is a twisted two cocycle. There is one, And this is the formula that expresses, so to say, in local terms, so to say, as some residue of some operators when you have the commutators with the Dirac operator. So, I mean, that's the reason, I mean, I call it as a sort of equivalent of Kolmogorovsky. Okay, so I finish by saying, what are the problems? I mean, okay, I mean, first, that's the one example. And to be honest, I believe that the Dirac operator is not wrong. Is wrong. I mean, although, I mean, we did it something like a year ago, but it was, you know, that was a single point in, you know, all family of objects. And now that we learned a little bit during this time, and in particular, there's no universal, I mean, I cannot see, for instance, at the moment, the universal formula for something like twisted local index formula, something like this, getting these twisted cyclic co-cycles, both for the standard and equatorial spheres. I mean, remember, I mean, we have this family, I mean, here this S0, here this S1. We have the spectral triples here, we have the spectral triples here. Actually, we can have the spectral triples for any. I mean, this is not really, at the moment, a very big deal. What's more even interesting, we have the spectral triple for SUQ2. And it would be sort of a nice thing to see that all the spectral triples for Podley spheres come as a sort of projections of spectral triple on a bigger space. So, and there's one thing, I mean, for the equatorial equatorial Podley sphere, the behavior of the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator, I should have written L plus 1/2, I mean, using the standard notation. It's something like, you know, you have, because the Hilbert space is just the Hilbert space of representation of UQSU2. So its behavior is just like L plus 1/2 with the 2L plus 1 multiplicity. For the standard, and that was the Dirac operator that was used here, for the standard Podley sphere, the behavior is like a Q number. I mean, the behavior that we had is like a Q number. So, you know, it's a huge difference. Well, we believe at the moment that, you know, it was just a coincidence that we landed at this one, and, okay, sort of conjecture is that the good Dirac operator for the standard one would be also of this type, so without Q numbers. But this, I mean, will have huge influences on the local index formula. At the moment, we see no, I mean, what we'd like to have is, you know, is prescription for a local index formula that will apply to both, sort of universal one. And this is still, you know, well, having some conjectures, but, I mean, this is still, you know, beyond, you know, fixed understanding at the moment. Now, for instance, I mean, we have bounded commutators, but, you know, the spectral properties of this Dirac operator is absolutely different. And moreover, if you assume that the Dirac operator is actually the same, so here, I mean, it should be, you know, actually, because, I mean, you can allow any Dirac operator that's, that has eigenvalues less than that. So in particular, you can allow the Dirac operator to be like that, to have bounded commutators. Then if you allow like that, then the commutators for the standard Podley sphere here are not only bounded, but are compact. I mean, so they are really infinitesimal. So this is, you know, something like strange. Now, basically, I mean, one little remark that there's, we have a feeling that there's something interesting going on, because, I mean, actually all this, I mean, when I'm writing compact, it simply means that there's no, all the commutators that I here write compact, they land in a certain ideal of operators. And this ideal is, well, according at least to Wojcicki, is quite an interesting. It's sort of geometric ideal with very nice properties. All right. So now the final thing, I mean, assuming that we go over that and have something like a local index formula, at least we have this cyclic co-cycle. The question is, what's the pairing with K-theory? And, of course, what K-theory should we actually pair it with? And there's a proposition, I mean, I just want to finish with that, by Nishayev and Tusset, that do the pairing with some sort of version of equivariant K-theory, and they have some sort of version of the index formula where the index is actually expressed as a formula that relates the pairing between the co-cycle and the projector with the index, but, I mean, it's not like index, it's Q minus index. So this is a proposition. But still, I mean, this proposition is somehow, I would say, tested on one example. So what we need probably to understand to go beyond that, we need, you know, going a little bit to some more examples. I mean, something like other spheres, something like SQ2, flag manifolds, and that's what people are doing. Thank you very much.